Okay, let's just jump right in. We're gonna unpack a case today that honestly, it sounds less like a technical exploit and more like something from a spy movie.
Oh, absolutely.
We're talking about a perfect invisible wiretap, one that wasn't discovered because an alarm went off, but because someone saw what you could only describe as a ghost in the machine.
And it's a cold case. This all happened back in 2023, but it has suddenly become, well, maybe the most critical security conversation we need to be having right now in 2026.
So tell us what we're looking at. What was the original incident?
We are examining the encrypted traffic interception of Jabber.ru and XMPP.ru. Now, these are massive, privacy-focused Russian messaging services,
Great.
and the discovery was made by a really seasoned UNIX admin username Oxpa. What he found was chilling because the evidence didn't point to, some lone hacker in a basement.
Yeah.
It pointed to a systemic compromise, a compromise at the level of the infrastructure providers themselves, specifically Hetzner and Linode in Germany.
So our mission today, looking back at this 3 years later, is really twofold. First, we need to walk through the forensic evidence. How did they come to the conclusion that this was likely a state-level interception and not just, a regular hack?
And then, this is the crucial part for today, we connect that 2023 cold case to a brand new analysis from this year, 2026.
An analysis which shows that the exact same attack mechanism is now a critical systemic vulnerability.
Yes, and it's because of what the author calls a deliberate design flaw in the internet's biggest gatekeeper, Cloudflare's Universal SSL service.
Okay, and what are our sources for this deep dive?
They're really rich. We have the original exhaustive investigation report from Oxpo, which goes into incredible detail. We're talking forensic steps, kernel memory dumps, the
Or
works.
and for the current situation.
We have the 2026 analysis that really dissects this collision between Cloudflare's features and what is supposed to be our strongest preventative security standard, RFC 8657.
Right, so let's set the scene. Go back to that moment of discovery because this is where the suspense really starts.
It's October 16th, 2023. Oxpa is doing a routine check. He connects to his service and gets an error message that any admin would recognize. Certificate expired.
Okay, annoying, but a pretty standard problem to have.
Exactly. Your first thought is, my renewal script failed.
Yeah.
So he immediately checks the server, checks his Let's Encrypt automation,
Sure.
and the server says, everything is fine. The certificate is brand new, it's perfectly valid. And that is the moment a routine problem turns into a nightmare.
Because if the server says the certificate is valid, but the client connecting to it sees an expired one.
There's really only one explanation. The server and the client are not talking to each other directly. Something is sitting in the middle.
And it wasn't just expired, was it? When they dug in, the forensics showed it was a completely different certificate.
Precisely. The client was receiving an outdated certificate that was generated with a totally different private key.
A key the real server had never seen.
Never. The server's own ACME script had never issued it, never stored it. It was, as you said, a ghost certificate. A perfect, transparent, man-in-the-middle proxy was just sitting there
Yeah.
between the user and the server, quietly serving its own forged credentials.
And the only reason it was discovered was a clerical error. The interceptor forgot to renew the ghost's ID.
That's the only reason.
That is just, it's chilling. It's like you're looking at your mail carrier, everything seems normal, but then you notice this tiny, almost invisible detail on their uniform that proves they're an impersonator.
A perfect impersonator, standing exactly where the real one should be.
The attacker didn't break in, they just replaced the entire pathway.
And that's where the real investigation begins. The administrators knew right away how serious this was.
So their first job must have been to prove definitively that their own servers hadn't been breached.
Exactly. Because if you can find a rootkit or some malicious software, okay, the problem is bad, but it's contained to your systems. You can wipe them and rebuild.
So this is where they really had to bring out the big forensic tools.
Oh, yeah. They went deep. Of course, they did the standard stuff log reviews, file modification dates, check and running processes. All that came up clean.
But they had to go deeper than that, to be sure.
Much deeper. They used tools like LIME, that's LIME, the Linux memory extractor. They used it to do a full volatile memory dump.
And then analyze that dump with volatility.
Right.
So, for those of us who haven't done a kernel memory dump on a live server, what does that actually rule out? Why is that considered the gold standard?
Because LIME and volatility are how you find the truly invisible malware. A lot of sophisticated rootkits these days, they don't leave any traces on the hard drive. They operate entirely in the kernel's memory.
Using techniques like LDPR eload libraries or inserting their own kernel modules, right?
Exactly. They hijack system calls to hide their own activity.
Yeah.
But if a piece of malware is actively running, it has to leave a footprint in memory. There's no way around that. So analyzing the kernel memories lets you spot these things that are otherwise completely hidden.
And the verdict. For both the dedicated machine they had on Hexner and the virtual servers on Linode.
Completely clean.
Wow.
No signs of hidden kernel modules, no suspicious processes, no modified system files. Internally, the servers were untouched.
And that immediately shifts the suspicion, right? It's not the victim's machine. It has to be the ground it's standing on.
The network environment. The one provided by the hosting companies.
So if the machine itself is clean, maybe the attacker was a neighbor in the same virtual rack, doing some kind of local network attack.
That was the next thing to check. Simple layer two attacks, like ARP spoofing or ICMP redirects.
Where one machine basically pretends to be another one on the local network.
Yes, and they checked for all of that. Exhaustively. Rogue routing rules, weird tunnels, you name it. They ruled out all the standard neighbor attacks. The machine's local configuration was totally secure.
Okay, so let's just recap for a second. The servers are clean. The local network is clean.
The ghost has to be in the foundation of the house.
In the network hardware controlled by Hetzner and Linode. So what was the smoking gun? What did they find that pointed specifically at a compromise of the hosting provider?
Well, there are really three key pieces of evidence here, all specific to the Hetzner and Linode infrastructure in Germany.
Let's start with the Linode isolation. That seems like a huge red flag, a sign the machine was being deliberately quarantined.
It is. It's a very powerful sign. The affected Linode VMs, the virtual machines, were completely unable to ARP discover or even ping any of their neighbors.
Their neighbors meaning other IP addresses in the same local network segment?
Exactly. IPs that were perfectly accessible from the outside internet, but from the targeted VM, they were invisible.
Huh.
And here's the kicker. An unaffected Linode VM in the same region connected to a known Cisco router. It could ping its neighbors just fine. But the targeted machines were connected to some unidentified Mac manufacturer and seemed totally isolated.
Which suggests they had been moved.
Deliberately moved into a separate quarantined VLAN, a virtual local area network.
So the rules of the neighborhood were changed, but only for the target. It wasn't allowed to talk to its neighbors anymore.
Which is classic preparation for this kind of interception. You isolate the target so it can't run network diagnostics that might reveal the intercepting machine you've inserted into the path. You're quietly funneling its traffic.
Okay, that's damning. What's the second piece of evidence? You mentioned a trace route.
Right, the trace route. This is a bit more complex, but it's probably the most definitive piece of network evidence they found. It shows the physical location of the interceptor.
How so?
So when they ran a standard trace route from an outside laptop, they saw a really weird discrepancy depending on which port they were targeting.
A discrepancy?
Yes. For non-hijacked ports, like SSH on port 22, the trace showed an extra undisclosed hop, let's say, hop 14 before it reached the server.
Okay.
But the hijacked port, the XMPP port 5222, was reachable directly on hop 13.
Wait, one fewer hop for the hijacked traffic? That seems backward. Wouldn't adding a man-in-the-middle proxy add an extra hop? It's counterintuitive, I know. But no, the fact that it's one fewer hop on the hijacked port means the interceptor is sitting closer to you on the network path than the legitimate server's actual entry point.
Ah, I see.
Confirms the victim VM's IP address had been placed behind another machine. A machine programmed to handle TCP port 5222 all by itself. That machine, that was the transparent MyTM proxy.
So the path was basically router, then interceptor hop 13.
Right.
And then the real server at hop 14, but only for the traffic the interceptor wasn't interested in.
Correct. The interceptor at hop 13 was splitting the traffic. It handled port 5222 entirely, and it just forwarded everything else, like port 22, onto the real machine. This is sophisticated network-level traffic splitting. It's a maneuver that only the hosting provider or someone with dedicated access to their core network hardware could pull off.
Okay, and the last piece of evidence you mentioned connects a physical event to the attacker getting a new certificate. This is the kernel log clue from the Hetzner dedicated machine. The logs show the machine physically losing its network link for exactly 19 seconds on July 18th, 2023.
Just a 19-second outage.
Right, and when they cross-reference that exact timestamp with the public certificate transparency logs,
the public record of all issued certs,
they discovered that a new robe certificate for jabber.ruu was issued on. July 18th, 2023, right around the exact same time the link went down.
Wow, that's not a coincidence.
It looks suspiciously like the network device controlling the traffic was taken offline for a few seconds, reconfigured to let the attacker pass the certificate validation challenge, and then brought back online with the new interception rules and the rogue certificate ready to go.
This brings us to the most contentious part of the original report. The admin team concluded this was lawful interception Hetzner and Linode were forced to set up based on German police request. That is a massive claim. Why jump to lawful interception and not, say, a really, really sophisticated criminal hacker?
It really came down to the surgical precision and the institutional silence. A criminal hacker, even a sophisticated one, usually leaves some trace, or they leverage the access for profit, they steal data, they deploy ransomware, something.
Right.
This attack was purely about sustained surveillance on a non-profitable communication service. It required deep, persistent access to core routing hardware. That's not the typical MO for a criminal group.
And what about the response from Hetzner and Linode?
That's the other part. The silence spoke volumes. They were presented with this incredibly detailed forensic evidence, the kernel logs, the traceroute data, the MAC vendor issue, and Linode just replied that they observed no illegal activity impacting your services. Hetzner gave a complete non-answer, basically saying they only provide hardware and network access and couldn't help.
A total stonewall.
A complete stonewall.
Right.
And you have to think, if this was a regular criminal compromise, the host would be highly motivated to investigate, to protect their reputation, to protect their other customers.
But they didn't.
Their refusal to even acknowledge or investigate this level of network manipulation strongly suggested they were either complicit or, much more likely, operating under a non-disclosure order.
A gag order.
Coercion by a state actor, likely under German jurisdiction, which is where the servers were.
And the implication of that is just terrifying.
It means all Jabber.U and XMPP.U communications between April and October of 2023 have to be considered compromised. Message content, user lists, maybe even real-time message modification. The integrity of the entire service was just gone, wiped out by this invisible upstream tampering.
Okay, so this brings us to the mechanism, the how. This is the core of the problem that's still with us in 2026.
Right.
The big challenge for the Interceptor wasn't breaking the encryption. That's basically impossible. It was about identity theft. They had to convince a certificate authority, Let's Encrypt, to give them a valid, trusted ID card for the domain they were targeting.
That is the absolute core of it. They exploited the single point of failure in the domain validation model, specifically the most convenient and, well, the most vulnerable method, the HTTP/01 challenge.
So they didn't steal the victim's private key.
No, they just convinced the trusted third party, Let's Encrypt, to issue a brand new legitimate key to them, the attacker.
All right, let's use the post office analogy here. I think this is really crucial to understand why this is so dangerous, especially with the new 2026 findings.
Yeah, absolutely. So think about normal encryption. You're sending a private letter, that's your data, to a friend, the server.
Okay.
To keep it private, you put that letter inside a steel box, which is the TLS encryption. Only your friend has the unique private key to open that box. That's a secure connection.
Simple enough. Now, the man in the middle attacker wants to read your mail. They can't break the lock on the steel box.
Right, so they have to intercept it. But they can't just use any old lock because your client software will see it's a fake and reject it. They need a legitimate steel box with the right official stamp on it.
So they have to trick the Postal Service, which is our certificate authority, Let's Encrypt.
Exactly. They trick them into issuing a brand new, legitimate steel box addressed to the same location, but keyed to the attacker's private key.
So how does the CA, the Postal Service, verify the identity of the person asking for this new box?
The CA needs proof that the requester actually controls the address, the domain name. So it sends a verification check, the domain validation challenge, to that address. In this case, the attacker chose the vulnerable HTTP/01 method.
And what does that HTTP/01 challenge look like in our analogy?
It's like the Postal Service saying, okay, to prove you live at this address, go put this specific, unique flag in your front window where we can see it from the street.
The flag being a verification file on the web server.
Right, in a specific public directory. The CA then connects over standard HTTP before any encryption starts to look for that file.
And this is where the hosting provider interception is the key. The attacker didn't need to hack the server to place that file or that flag in the window.
Precisely. The hosting provider had already set up the interception. The attacker's machine, the MyTM proxy, was just sitting there silently waiting. So when the CA came calling, asking to see the flag,
The interceptor's machine answered the door.
We answered the door.
Yeah.
It intercepted the CA's request, showed it the correct flag from its own storage, and proved control of the domain to the CA.
So the infrastructure itself, the post office, basically built a fake recipient's house right inside the facility.
Yes.
So when Let's Encrypt came to check the address, the fake house answered, passed the test, and the CA, none the wiser, happily handed over a brand new, valid certificate tied to the attacker's key.
And that rogue certificate was then used to impersonate the server. The attacker decrypts the user's traffic, reads it, logs it, and then re-encrypts it with the legitimate server's key before sending it on. To the user, it looks totally normal. The green padlock is there. It's invisible.
Invisible until they made one simple mistake. They forgot to renew a 3-month certificate.
It's a perfect example of operational security failure undone by a lack of basic automation. They had this sophisticated network tap running for months, issued multiple rogue certs, but missed a routine renewal. The proxy started serving the expired credential, and that's what triggered the alarm.
And there was another technical fingerprint they left behind, right? The anonymous NUL ciphers.
Yes, this is a deep technical tell. It confirms that a piece of malicious middleware was inserted. When Oxpa ran a detailed security scanner against the hijacked port, it reported that the connection accepted anonymous NUL ciphers.
Which is not something you see every day.
Not at all. It's an ancient, insecure, highly specialized configuration. And most importantly, the real Jabber.ru server did not and would never accept these ciphers.
So the attacker's proxy was misconfigured in a way that left this unique, traceable flaw.
Exactly. It's like a spy leaving a piece of their custom-made, highly specialized radio equipment at the scene of the crime. It proved, beyond any doubt, that a purpose-built proxy was sitting in the network path, engineered to decrypt and re-encrypt traffic. It wasn't just some simple redirection error.
Okay, so we've established the threat. Network interception is real, hosting providers can be coerced, and the Achilles heel is that HTTP/01 certificate challenge.
Right.
So we found the hole in 2023. We should have patched the system. Why are we sitting here in 2026 saying this vulnerability is now critical again?
Because 3 years later, the preventative fix we desperately need is being actively undermined by the very platforms that are meant to secure the internet.
We have a standard to stop this, don't we?
We do. It's called Certification Authority Authorization Record Extensions for Account URI and ACME Method Binding. It was published as RFC 86507 all the way back in November 2019.
So the solution is more than 6 years old, but it's not being used where it matters most.
And that's because of Cloudflare. And look, we can't overstate their position in the ecosystem. They're not just some company. They are critical internet infrastructure. They handle something like 20% of all websites and have an 81.6% market share among reverse proxy providers.
So when they make a design choice, it has massive ripple effects for millions of people.
Huge effects. And the new analysis shows that their most popular feature, Universal SSL, actively nullifies the security controls that RFC 86507 provides. It's not a bug, it's a feature collision. Or, to be blunt, it's a commercial decision that prioritizes convenience over preventative security.
How does it do that? How does Universal SSL undermine the fix?
It's all about control and automation. Universal SSL gives free, automatic certificates to everyone. To make that scale smoothly with no user intervention, Cloudflare's system automatically injects what are called permissive CAA records into your domain's DNS.
Which would be something like issue.letsencrypt.org.
Exactly. That basic record just tells any CA, yep, Let's Encrypt is allowed to issue a certificate for this domain.
Which, as the Jabber.ru case proved, isn't nearly enough to stop an interceptor. The attacker used Let's Encrypt.
Precisely. The power of RFC 86507 is that it lets you add strict preventative rules, like locking certificate issuance to only your specific account ID, or forbidding the vulnerable HTTP/01 method entirely. These are the locks you need.
So what happens when a security-conscious admin, who knows about the Jabber.ru threat, tries to add those strict RFC 8667 records to their domain while they're using Universal SSL?
Cloudflare's automation sees those strict records as an obstacle. They conflict with the needs of Universal SSL, which requires general permission to issue certs on your behalf. So the system either overrides, ignores, or just replaces your strict security records with its own permissive ones.
So the secure configuration is just rejected by the automation.
Yes. The analysis showed that if you try to add an account to your record to lock issuance to your unique account, Cloudflare just replaces it with the generic permissive issue letsencrypt.org record.
So you think you've secured your domain, but the lock is gone.
The lock is gone. The crucial preventative control is absent from the DNS.
Okay, let's use the bouncer analogy here. I think that really clarifies the trade-off they're making.
Right, so think of CA records as the guest list for a secure club. Basic CAA, the old standard, is just a rule that says only people with an ID from the Let's Encrypt brand are allowed in.
Which is fine until the attacker shows up with a perfectly valid Let's Encrypt ID card like they did with Jabber.ru.
Exactly. RSC 8657 is the real security lock. It's the detailed, specific guest list. The accountori is the person's exact name and photo ID. The validation methods rule dictates how they're allowed to enter, say, only through the secure back door, not the easily watched front entrance.
And Cloudflare, acting as the bouncer for millions of domains, basically throws away your strict, personalized guest list.
Right.
And instead just posts a big sign out front that says, anyone with an ID from Let's Encrypt can come in.
It's the cost of scale and convenience. They want to provide free instant security for everyone. And to do that, they sacrifice the granular control that RFC 8657 provides.
But the critical implication is that they're actively reopening the exact door that a state-level actor walked through in 2023.
They're creating the conditions for that MITM attack vector to flourish again, right now, in 2026. And that raises a really profound question.
Which is, are we now in a world where the best preventative security against a demonstrated, sophisticated attack is effectively paywalled?
That's the inescapable conclusion here. For most users on their free or pro plans, the strongest technical defense against this entire class of attack is simply unavailable, not unless you move off their platform or upgrade to a very expensive business or enterprise plan.
Okay, we need to spend some time on this failed silver bullet. The reason this refusal to adopt RFC 8657 is such a big deal isn't just a principle. It's about what those two specific parameter, accountori and invalidation methods, actually do on a technical level.
Let's start by just making the difference between the two standards crystal clear. The old one, RFC 8639, is just brand-level trust. It ensures that if you only list issue letsencrypt.org, a rogue request to, say, digicert will be rejected.
Yeah.
It stops some simple mistakes.
But it does nothing if the attacker tricks the authorized brand Let's Encrypt, which is exactly what happened with Jabber.ru.
Precisely. And that's where the extension, RFC 8657, comes in. It adds process-level trust, cryptographic identity binding. Let's start with accountori.
So accountori, in simple terms,
it is the second factor for getting a certificate. When you first run a client like Certbot, it creates a unique private key for your ACME account with the CA. The accountori field in your DNS locks all certificate issuance for your domain to that specific account ID.
So if Jabber.ru had this deployed back in 2023, even with the network interception, the attacker would have been requesting the certificate using their own different ACME account ID.
And Let's Encrypt would have rejected it instantly. The CA would check the DNS, see the strict accountori pointing only to the legitimate admin's ID, and see the attacker's request was a mismatch. Certificate denied. Hugo Landau, the guy who authored the RFC, confirmed this would have made the entire Jabber.ru network interception completely irrelevant for getting a certificate.
That's the power of prevention. So that's accountori. What about the second parameter, validation methods?
Validation methods is the attack vector shield. It lets you completely forbid the challenge types that are vulnerable to network interception, specifically HTTP/01.
Let's just expand on why HTTP/01 is so much weaker than the alternative, DNS/01.
So the HTTP/01 challenge proves you control the web server. It does this by checking for a file over an unencrypted connection on port 80. That validation check has to travel across the public internet.
Which makes it vulnerable.
It makes it vulnerable to anyone who can temporarily redirect that traffic for that single check. There's a famous threat model from Princeton back in 2018 showing how an attacker could use BGP hijacking to reroute internet traffic, intercept the CA's validation request, get the cert, and then stop the hijack. All invisible to the domain owner.
And the Jabber.ru attack was basically a real-world execution of that threat model, just at a local provider level instead of a global BGP level.
Exactly. The weakness is the same. You're proving control via unencrypted network traffic. The solution is DNS-01.
And how does that work?
The DNS-01 challenge requires you to prove control of the DNS zone. To do this, you have to put a specific cryptographically derived TXT record into your domain's DNS.
Why is controlling the DNS more secure than controlling the web server traffic?
Because they're usually managed by completely different systems and infrastructure. To compromise DNS/01, you generally need access to the domain registrar account or the DNS provider's credentials. It is a much, much harder target to hit than just redirecting some HTTP packets by coercing an ISP.
So by setting validation methods, DNS/01, You are explicitly telling all CAs, don't even try the network vulnerable HTTP method. You must use the DNS method.
You're rendering that entire class of network interception attacks useless for certificate fraud. You're separating your assets. You're protecting your application by relying on the security of your name resolution.
Which brings us back to the big question. Given how effective these controls are, and the standard has been out since 2019, why is Cloudflare refusing to implement them for most users?
Well, their official line has often been something like, the standard isn't widely adopted, or we have to wait for it to be passed.
Which is just not true. It was passed 6 years ago.
Exactly. And the source material we're looking at highlights the hypocrisy here by pointing to Cloudflare's own engineering history.
Right. They pride themselves on being innovators.
They do. They implemented TLS 1.3 2 years before the RFC was finalized. They supported GUIC 3 years before it was published. They're supporting encrypted client hello right now, and it's still just a draft.
So they have a history of pushing for security standards ahead of the curve.
But when it comes to RFC 8657, a standard that closes a demonstrated real-world state-level attack vector, suddenly they have to wait for universal industry adoption. It's inconsistent.
So what's the real reason?
The conclusion from the security community is that it's a business decision. Implementing RFC 8657 properly would mean their automated system would have to handle and track millions of unique user ACME account IDs. That adds a lot of computational and database complexity.
Complexity they're willing to manage for their high-paying enterprise clients, but not for their free and pro users.
That's the gatekeeping. By restricting the ability to disable universal SSL and use these strict controls to their business or enterprise plans, they are putting the solution to the Jabber.ul attack behind a massive paywall.
It's the ultimate platform dilemma, when automation and scale clash with granular security.
Automation wins, and the security risk gets transferred right back to you, the end user.
So the wider industry has recognized this threat. It's not just Cloudflare. There's another layer of defense being built, right?
Yes. The CA Browser Forum, which sets the rules for certificate issuance, has worked on a complementary solution. It's called Multi-Perspective Issuance Corroboration, or MPIC.
And what does MPIC aim to solve?
It basically shifts the burden of proof to the CAs themselves. It acknowledges that a single network check from one location isn't good enough anymore. MPIC requires CAs to check domain validation from multiple independent network vantage points.
So instead of the CA just checking from one data center in Virginia, they now have to check from Virginia and Frankfurt and Singapore all at the same time.
Precisely. The goal is to make a temporary localized network interception exponentially harder to pull off. The requirements are being phased in right now, actually. It's a minimum of 3 independent perspectives by March of this year, 2026.
So an attacker would need to hijack traffic from 3 globally dispersed locations simultaneously.
Which is a much higher bar. It's a fantastic complementary defense. It really helps against those opportunistic BGP hijacks.
What? And there's a but here, isn't there? It doesn't replace RFC 8657.
It absolutely does not. This is the crucial distinction. MPIC is a robust defense against network attacks that are trying to trick the CA into thinking the attacker is the domain owner.
But it doesn't solve the problem of a platform like Cloudflare, where the platform itself might be compelled or its system is just designed to be permissive.
No. If you're on a platform that overrides your strict account ID lock, Contori, the attacker doesn't need to spoof the network from 3 different places. They just need to make a request through the permissive system that the platform already controls.
So MPIC verifies the validation request is coming from the right place, but RFC 8657 verifies it's coming from the right person.
And if the platform nullifies the person check, the hole is still wide open.
Okay, so for most of the internet, the strongest form of prevention is inaccessible. Given that reality, what's the survival guide? How do you protect yourself?
The sources outline a very clear 2-tiered strategy. If prevention is paywalled, then detection becomes mandatory.
Let's start with prevention, the expensive but comprehensive option.
Right. If you're running a high-stakes service like these XMTP servers or Tor relays or VPN endpoints, and you absolutely require the strictness of RFC 8657, you have to disengage from the platform's automated system. For a Cloudflare user, that means going into your dashboard and disabling universal SSL.
Which means you're on your own for certificates.
You are. You have to upload custom certificates that you've issued yourself using your own strictly locked down ACME account. And the catch, which we have to repeat, is that the ability to upload custom certs is restricted to their business or enterprise plans.
So for millions of users, prevention is just off the table financially, which means detection is their only remaining defense.
Detection becomes your most critical operational security task. You have to implement rigorous certificate transparency monitoring. The CT system is a public, verifiable log of almost every certificate issued on the internet.
Let's use the doorbell analogy here. How does that work in practice?
CT is your doorbell. Every time a CA issues a new certificate for your domain, it gets logged publicly. You need a monitoring service that rings a metaphorical phone or sends you an email the instant a new key is made for your house.
And if you see a certificate issued that you didn't ask for,
you panic. That is your one and only warning that an attacker is preparing an interception.
What are the tools for this? How do you set up that doorbell?
There are automated services like CertSpotter or CertStream, though they can be pricey. But the CT logs themselves are public. You can use search engines like security.sh to check them manually. The key is rapid detection. You have to spot the rogue cert as soon as it's issued before it can be used against your users.
But there's a big hole in relying on CT monitoring, isn't there?
Yeah.
Especially for non-web services like XMPP.
This is a critical caveat, yes.
Yeah.
Modern web browsers are great. They generally reject any certificate unless it contains cryptographic proof, an SCT, that it was logged to a CT log. But most other TLS clients, XMPP clients, mail servers, VPN clients, they don't enforce these proofs.
So a sophisticated attacker could just ask for an unlogged certificate and bypass the whole detection system?
Precisely. CAs are allowed to issue unlogged certificates for certain privacy reasons. An adversary operating under coercion could potentially request one for their MITM operation. If they succeed, your entire CT monitoring setup is useless because the evidence never shows up in the public log.
Which means the real recommendation here has to be that all this other client software, XMPP, VPNs, everything, needs to urgently add support for CT-proof enforcement, just like browsers do.
It's a massive security gap in non-browser infrastructure.
So this whole deep dive has really shown that the lessons from that 2023 invisible wiretap were not learned. The vulnerability is still here, not because of a technical mistake, but because of commercial design choices.
It's that uncomfortable trade-off. We used to worry about the hacker drilling through our walls. Now you have to worry about the landlord, the hosting provider, the cloud gatekeeper, who is either coerced or just willingly letting them in with a master key.
All because they prioritized making the front door easy for everyone to use over ensuring only the right person can get in.
The conclusion from the Jabber.Ritchu admins that the silence from Hetzner and Linode implied state-level coercion should be a perpetual warning for everyone. The second you put your data on an external provider, you outsource your security to the jurisdiction that governs them.
We have to move past this idea of passive trust.
We have to assume services can be compromised and push for robust end-to-end encryption with key validation that happens at the user level, independent of all this infrastructure.
Let's end with that final provocative thought then, something that takes this transparency discussion even further.
Well, the problem we've highlighted is that even RFC 8657 often relies on DNSSEC to protect the CAA records themselves. But even DNSSEC can be defeated if an attacker compels your domain registrar or TLD registry to change your DNSSEC signing keys, the DS records.
A deeper level of coercion.
It's harder to pull off, but it's still too difficult for the public to detect in real time.
So if certificate transparency was the solution for identity, what's the next step for infrastructure integrity?
The provocative thought is this. What if we had a public transparency solution for DNSSEC zone keys, a system that publicly logs every single change to a domain's critical DS records, making it cryptographically impossible for a registrar or a registry to be silently coerced or compromised without immediate global public detection?
A paper trail for the most fundamental trust assets of the internet.
Making that final coercion vector much riskier and much more detectable. It's the necessary next layer of defense against a threat that has evolved from simple hacking to institutional co-option.
So the call to action for you, the listener, is demanding, but it's simple.
Check your CAA records. See what locks your platform actually lets you set. Understand the difference between prevention, which is RFC 8657, and detection, which is CT monitoring, and never, ever trust a green padlock blindly.
The attack surface isn't just your server anymore. It's the entire digital supply chain that sits between you and your users.